Welcome back to the Hemingway List, the podcast where we do things the Hemingway. We're talking about Chapter 5, Part 2 of The Enormous Room, and I'm enjoying a nice cup of hot chocolate. So delicious. Reminder, check out the interview I did with young Aaron Huggins, author of... Oh, there's been a serious development. Oh my gosh. Author of Live a Little, a science fiction murder mystery novel. While I do this, yesterday I extended the invitation out to the War and Peace. I should have seen this coming, actually, now that I think about it. I extended the invitation to the War and Peace community, the A Year of War and Peace community, saying, hey, if any of you guys are interested in some more daily reading, we're currently voting on what to read next over at the Hemingway List, and invited them to vote. And, oh gosh, there has been a development. The Red and the Black by Stendhal was clearly in the lead, with a majority votes by a good 30% more. I think it had about 38% of the pie graph, and the next highest was something like 20.
What's up, doggy?
Sorry, I've got a dog alert. The dog has just come into the room and looked at me. It's looking at me and snuffling, and I don't know what it means. It's one of those Shar Pei dogs. You know, those dogs with way too much skin. It's kind of like a bulldog, but a bit different. And it's now just standing near me, licking its foot. I might tend to this dog and just see what it wants. Sorry about that. All right, so it was The Red and the Black was clearly going to be our next book. I extended the invite to the War and Peace community, and overnight we've had quite a few votes, and it looks like nearly all of them were for Anna Karenina, because that is now in the lead by, it has 36.5% of the votes, and Stendhal's The Red and the Black has dropped all the way down to 18.9%. So it looks like we might be reading some Tolstoy next, interestingly enough, if everyone's happy with that. I would like to know, I'd like to know about this vote, because I'm a little bit sus. It might be that, these people all love Tolstoy on account of the fact that they are reading War and Peace. But I also feel like maybe someone just voted lots of times, because that's a lot of votes, and it looks like the other voting didn't really change much. Like, in order for this to have happened, there needs to be a lot of votes come through for Anna Karenina and not many votes come through for the others, if any. So, you know what? I might have to investigate that. I'm going to do it right now by creating a spreadsheet of the results. All right. So, what I can see here by my investigation is that on the 8th of the 7th, Anna Karenina was voted for quite a lot. But it's pretty even spread, actually. Someone's voted War and Peace, someone's voted Henry James, Of Human Bondage, The Red and the Black. Alright. Very interesting. Okay, sorry, this is terrible podcasting. I'm just looking at a spreadsheet. Oh, gosh, okay. So it looks like we're reading Anna Karenina next. Dear Lord, help me. I was actually looking forward to The Red and the Black. I am also really looking forward to reading Anna Karenina, because I loved War and Peace. I really liked that book. So, yeah, cool. All right. I'm not officially announcing that yet, so don't rush out and buy your copies of Anna Karenina. But in the next day or two, I'll announce the next book. Who would you cast as Cummings in a book of The Enormous Room? That's the question I asked you guys about this chapter. And what was your favorite... Oh no, what did you take away as the purpose of this chapter? Those were the questions. I cast Eddie Redmayne as Cummings or Tom Hiddleston. Both can pull off the charisma without being stupidly handsome or muscular. I want to say James McAvoy too, but that might just be because he's one of my favourite actors. First of all, Eddie Redmayne and Tom Hiddleston, aren't they both British? And Cummings is an American. And James McAvoy, is he British or American? I'm not sure. I think he might be an American. Swim said the Mama Fish, he said James McAvoy is too old. He's 40 and Cummings was only around 23 when this happened. Redmayne and Hiddleston are in their late 30s. All are too old, and I can say this definitively because I am old. Smiley face. If I were to go with a known actor, I'd pick Timothy Chalamet. He is age-appropriate and has been favourably reviewed for his performances. I don't know who that is. I'm going to Google it really quick. Timothy Chalamet. Oh, man, I've searched for him and I still don't recognise him. He was the little boy in Interstellar, apparently. Okay, that's an obscure one. Good job. I Am Norwegian also said, what did you take away from the purpose of this chapter? I hope to God that it was just setting the scene and that we're getting to the meat of the story now. I did like the one-armed mechanic or whatever, but I'm starting to understand the whole read a chapter and retain almost nothing thing you struggled with reading Karamazov. Also, you mentioned an influx of subscribers. I did mention the subreddit over at r/bookclapreviewclap in a post about Anna Karenina. Something I noticed from trying to drum up interest in our discussions over at Dostoevsky and r/Hermann Hesse is that it's easy to get subscribers but hard to get active participants. Still, we might end up with a couple of new faces when we start the book. Yeah, the thing I've noticed here is that every time we start a new book, we'll get some new faces in the discussions. Like Nifty Riffic, who's popped in and has been very active and a really welcome addition to the conversation. Like Nifty Riffic has come and just fits right in, I think. And there's a few other names, although I can't see them at the moment, so they've skipped my mind. But yeah, I love that when we start a new book, we get a little bit of a new crowd, and then we've got the OGs as well. Like myself and Tech and Laura Weistich and Norwegian and Swims at the Mama Fishy. Laura Weistich said, I hope to God, quoting, that it was just setting the scene and we're getting to the meat of the story now. I agree. This chapter dragged and it's hard to remember so many characters when all you have are their descriptions but not much story. The journey to arrive at the enormous room was more interesting. Yeah, it was. I think the journey, the first few chapters were quite interesting and enticing and what's the word I'm looking for? Intriguing. But since being in the room, I feel a bit trapped there. And just describing the things and the setting and the people, it's not effective storytelling. You know, we don't read a story to just be told a bunch of descriptions in a row. We want to discover these things in a way that feels like we are discovering them through the action that is unfolding. Techrific said that final line, though, the good Lord, drunk as a pig, yeez. Oh, that's a translation of the final line, which was in French. I didn't know what that said, so thank you very much. The good Lord, drunk as a pig. I can't put my finger on why, but I'm struggling with this book, says Techrific. It's disjointed. I usually don't mind a lyrical style, but this is a strain on my mind at times. Maybe it's the whole point that Cummings was attempting. We're perhaps fooled by the wry humour, but behind it lurks the fear. Dark and ominous. What's going to happen? Maybe I'm just tired. I'm unused to following a strict reading schedule, not of my own choosing, and right now there are other books that I like to read more. Maybe it's a case of The Grass is Always Greener, KBO, onwards and upwards. Nifty Riffic said, anytime I've written something based on my own memories, it becomes sort of fluid ramblings. In the moment, I am so anxious to convey these remembered fleeting details, I would say that anything I've written remotely memoirish is definitely disjointed. Disjointed, by the way, is just the perfect word to describe this book. Completely agree that there are other things I'd rather be reading. Sorry, EE. Edit Paul Dano as Cummings, and not just because he played Pierre. That's a good choice. He might be a bit old as well, though, by now. But, yeah, I can picture him as especially him in like early years, There Will Be Blood, aged Paul Dano. Great actor. Swim said the mum. Fisher said, I agree with your fluid ramblings comment. What sets E.E. apart for me is that his ramblings are absolutely more lyrical than mine would ever be. I think that is why Hemingway included this book on the list. Yeah, I think that's probably why. The lyricism. Also, nifty-rific. Awesome to learn that you do a bit of writing. I'd love to know to what extent. Have you written any books? Short stories? Anything published? Let us know. Buck up, said Swim, said the Mama Fishy. We committed to the Hemingway list. Plus, you and I both thought that this book would be more fun than it is turning out to be. I bet there are a bunch of people out there saying, what the F? Buck up. Yeah. I'm in that boat as well. I was really looking forward to this book. And I still, you know, it's just been a bad couple of chapters. But I liked the intro. And I could say, I could definitely see myself saying, like, it just dipped at a certain point and picked back up. Sure. And hopefully that's how it goes. Tech Griffick said, I hear you, and yes, I certainly thought it would be a nice break from Dosto's imitation of the country doctor's excited logorrhea. Buck up. Yeah, you can do it. Tech, we can get through this together. Keep your pecker up, as my grandma would hilariously say without knowing why we were all laughing at her. Keep your pecker up. That's the conversation we're having around Chapter 5, Part 2. Now we're going to read Chapter 6, Part 1, the first half of Chapter 6, which goes a little something like this. It's called Apollyon. 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 The inhabitant of the enormous room, whose portraits I have attempted in the preceding chapter, were, with one or two exceptions, inhabiting at the time of my arrival. Now the thing which above all things made death worth living and life worth dying at La Ferté Macé was the kinetic aspect of that institution. The arrivals, singly or in groups, of neveux of sundry nationalities, whereby our otherwise more or less simple existence was happily complicated, out putrescent placidity shaken by a fortunate violence. Sorry about the dog in the background. Before, however, undertaking this aspect, I shall attempt to represent for my own benefit, as well as the reader's, certain more obvious elements of that stasis which greeted the candidates for disintegration upon their admittance to our select, not to say distinguished, circle. Or I shall describe briefly Apollyon and the instruments of his power, which instruments are three in number, fear, women, and Sunday. By Apollyon, I mean a very definite fiend, a fiend who, secluded in the sumptuous and luxurious privacy of his own personal bureau, which, as a rule, no one of lesser rank than the surveillant was allowed, so far as I might observe, and I observed, to enter, compelled to the unimaginable meanness of his will by means of the three potent instruments in question, all within the sweating walls of La Ferté, that was once upon a time human. I mean a very complete Apollyon, a Satan whose word is dreadful, not because it is painstakingly unjust, but because it is incomprehensibly omnipotent. I mean, in short, Monsieur le Directeur. Excuse me while I go and strangle a dog. Oh my God. That dog. I swear they forgot to put a brain in that dog. You say its name, and it doesn't even register. It's like 3 years old. It doesn't know its own name. Where was I? I shall discuss, first of all, Monsieur le Directeur's most obvious weapon. Fear was instilled by three means into the erstwhile human entities whose presence at La Ferté gave Apollyon his job. The three means were through his subordinates, who, being one and all fearful of his power, directed their energies to but one end, the production in ourselves of a similar emotion through two forms of punishment, which supplied said subordinates with a weapon over any of us who refused to find room for this desolating emotion in his heart of hearts, and finally through direct contact with his unutterable personality. Beneath the demon was the surveillant. I have already described the surveillant. I wish to say, however, that in my opinion the surveillant was the most decent official at the La Ferté. I pay him this tribute gladly and honestly. To me at least he was kind. To the majority he was inclined to be lenient. I honestly and gladly believe that the surveillant was incapable of that quality whose innateness, in this case of his superior, rendered that gentleman a, to my mind, perfect representative of the almighty French government. I believe that the surveillant did not enjoy being cruel, that he was not absolutely without pity or understanding. As a personality, I therefore pay him my respects. I am myself incapable of caring whether, as a tool of the devil, he will find the bright firelight of hell too warm for him, or no. Beneath the surveillant were the secretary, Monsieur Richard, the cook, and the plantons. The first I have described sufficiently, since you've described them all sufficiently. You don't have to describe everyone. Like, you can just tell a story. Man, this is the advice I would give to a primary school student, not a Harvard graduate. The first I have described sufficiently, since he was an obedient and negative, albeit peculiarly responsible cog. Those are more descriptions. In the machine of decomposition. On Monsieur Richard, whose portrait is included in the account of my first day at Lafert, I wish to say that he had a very comfortable room of his own, filled with primitive and otherwise imposing medicines, descriptions, the wall of his comfortable room being beauteously adorned by some 50 magazine covers representing the female form in every imaginable state of undress, said magazine covers being taken chiefly from such amorous periodicals as Le Soirée and that old standby of indecency, La Vie Parisienne, descriptions. Also, Monsieur Richard kept a pot of geraniums upon his window ledge, a description, which haggard and aged-looking, two adjectives, symbol of joy he doubtless, in his spare moments, peculiarly enjoyed watering. Description. The cook is by this time familiar to the reader. I beg to say that I highly approve of the cook, exclusive of the fact that the coffee, which went up to the enormous room to Le Matins, was made every day with the same grounds, plus a goodly injection of checkerberry, for the simple reason that the cook had to supply our captors, and especially Apollyon, with real coffee, whereas what he supplied to Le Homme made no difference. The same is true of sugar. Our morning coffee, in addition to being a water-thin, black, muddy, stinking liquid, contained not the smallest suggestion of sweetness, whereas the coffee which went to the officials and the coffee which B and I drank in recompense for catching water had all the sugar you could possibly wish for. The poor cook was fined one day as a result of his economies subsequent to a united action on the part of the fellow sufferers. It was a day when a gent, immaculately dressed, appeared after duly warning the fiend that he was about to inspect the fiend's menage. And I think public official of Orne. Judas, at the time chef de chambre, supported by the sole and unique indignation of his fellow prisoners, save two or three, out of whom fear had made rabbits or moles, early carried the pail, which by common agreement not one of us had touched that day, downstairs, along the hall, and up one flight, where he encountered the director, surveillant, and handsome stranger, all amicably and pleasantly conversing. Judas set the pail down, bowed, and begged, as a spokesman for the united male gender of La Ferte Maitre, that the quality of the coffee be examined. We won't any of us drink it, begging your pardon, messieurs, he claims that he said. What happened then is highly amusing. The petit balayeur, an eyewitness of the proceeding, described it to me as follows. The director roared, comment? He was horribly angry. Oui, monsieur, said the maitre de chambre humbly. Pourquoi? Thundered the director. Because it's undrinkable, the maitre de chambre said quietly. Undrinkable nonsense, cried the director furiously. Be as so good as to taste it, monsieur le director. I taste it? Why should I taste it? The coffee is perfectly good, plenty good for you men. This is ridiculous. Why don't we all taste it? Suggested the surveillant ingratiatingly. Why, yes, said the visitor mildly. Taste it, of course. This is ridiculous, and I shall punish. I should like, if you don't mind, to try a little, the visitor said. Oh, well, of course, if you like, the director mildly agreed. Give me a cup of that coffee, you. With pleasure, sir, said the maitre de chambre. The director, Monsieur Jean, you would have burst laughing, seized the cup, lifted it to his lips, swallowed with a frightful expression, his eyes almost popping out of his head, and cried fiercely, delicious. The surveillant took a cupful, sipped, tossed the coffee away, looking as if he had been hit in the eyes, and remarked, ah, the maitre de chambre, Monsieur Jean, he is clever, scooped the third cupful from the bottom of the pail and very politely, with a big bow, handed it to the visitor, who took it, touched it to his lips, turned perfectly green and cried out, "Impossible, Monsieur Jean, we all thought, the director and the surveillant and the maitre d'chambre and myself, that he was going to vomit." He leaned against the wall a moment, quite green, then recovering, said faintly, "The kitchen." The director looked very nervous and shouted, trembling all over, "Yes, indeed. We'll see the cook about this perfectly impossible coffee." I had no idea that my men were getting such coffee. It's abominable. That's what it is, an outrage. And they all tottered downstairs to the cook. And Monsieur Jean, they searched the kitchen, and what do you think? They found 10 pounds of coffee and 12 pounds of sugar, all neatly hidden away, and the cook had been saving for himself out of our allowance. He's a beast, the cook. I must say, although the morning coffee improved enormously for as much as a week, it descended afterwards to its original level of excellence. The cook, I may add, officiated 3 times a week at a little table to the left as you entered the dining room. Here he stood and threw at everyone, as everyone entered, a hunk of the most extraordinary meat which I have ever had the privilege of trying to masticate. It could not be tasted. It was pale and leathery. B and myself often gave ours away in our hungriest moments, which statement sounds as if we were generous to others, whereas the reason for those donations was that we couldn't eat, let alone stand the sight of this staple of diet. We had to do our donating on the sly, since the chef always gave us choice pieces, and we were anxious not to hurt the chef's feelings. There was a good deal of spasmodic protestation apropos la viande, but the cook always bullied it down, nor was the meat his fault, since, from the miserable carcasses which I have often seen carried into the kitchen from without, the cook had to select something which would suit the meticulous stomach of the Lord of Hell, as also the less meticulous digestive organs of his minions, and it was only after every planton had got a piece of viande to his platonic taste that the captives, female and male, came in for consideration. On the whole, I think I never envied the cook his strange and difficult, not to say gruesome, job. With the men en masse, he was bound to be unpopular. To the goodwill of those above, he was necessarily more or less a slave, and on the whole, I liked the cook very much, as did B, for the very good and sufficient reason that he liked us both. About the plantons, I have something to say, something which it gives me huge pleasure to say. I have to say about the plantons that as a bunch they struck me at the time and will always impress me as the next to the lowest species of human organism, the lowest in my experienced estimation, being the gendarme proper. The plantons were, with one exception, he of the black holster with whom I collided on the first day, changed from time to time. Again, with this one exception, they were, as I have noted, apparently disabled men who were enjoying a vacation from the trenches in the lovely environs of Orne. Nearly all of them were witless. Every one of them had something the matter with him, physical as well. For instance, one planton had a large wooden hand, another was possessed of a long unimaginable left leg, made as nearly as I could discover of tin, a third had a huge glass eye. These peculiarities of physique, however, did not inhibit the plantons from certain essential and normal desires. On the contrary, the plantons probably realized that, in competition with the male world at large, their glass legs and tin hands and wooden eyes would not stand in a Chinaman's chance of winning the affection and admiration of the fair sex. Sorry, one second, I have to go deal with a stupid dog. At any rate, they were always on the alert for opportunities to triumph over the admiration and affectation of La Femme at La Ferté, where their success was not endangered by competition. They had the bulge on everybody, and they used what bulge they had to such good advantage that one of them, during my stay, was pursued with a revolver by the sergeant, captured, locked up, and shipped off for court-martial on the charge of disobedience and threatening the life of a superior officer. He had been caught with the goods, that is to say, in the girl's cabinot, by said superior, an incapable, strutting, undersized, bepimpled person in a bright uniform who spent his time assuming the poses of a general for the benefit of the ladies, of his admiration for whom and his intentions towards whom he made no secret. By all means, one of the most disagreeable, petty bullies whom I ever beheld. This arrest of a planton was, so long as I inhabited La Ferté, the only case in which abuse of the weaker sex was punished. That attempts at abuse were frequent, I know from allusions and direct statements made in the letters which passed by way of the sweeper from the girls to their captive admirers. I might say that the senders of these letters, whom I shall attempt to portray presently, have my unmitigated and unqualified admiration. By all odds, they possessed the most terrible vitality and bravery of any human beings, women or men, whom it has ever been my extraordinary luck to encounter, or ever will be, I am absolutely sure, in this world. The duties of the plantons were those simple and obvious duties which only very stupid persons can perfectly fulfil, namely, to take turns guarding the building and its inhabitants. Not to accept bribes, whether in the form of matches, cigarettes, or conversation, from their prisoners, to accompany anyone who went anywhere outside the walls, as did occasionally the balayeurs, to transport baggage, the men who did corvée, and the catches of water for the cook, who proceeded as far as the hydrant situation on the outskirts of the town, a momentous distance of perhaps 500 feet, and finally to obey any and all orders from all and any superiors without thinking. Plantons were supposed to, but only supposed to, report any schemes for escaping which they might overhear during their watch upon La Femme at Le Homme in promenade. Of course they never overheard any, since the least intelligent of the watched was a paragon of wisdom by comparison with the watchers. B and I had a little ditty about plantons, of which I can quote, unfortunately, only the first line and refrain. A planton loved a lady once, cabbages and cauliflowers. It was a very fine song. In concluding my remarks upon plantons, I must, in justice to my subject, mention the three prime platonic virtues. They were: one, beauty, as regards face and person and bearing; two, chivalry, as regards women; and three, heroism, as regards male. The somewhat unique and amusing appearance of the plantons rather militated against than served to inculcate fear. It was therefore not wonderful that they and the desired emotion were supported by two strictly enforced punishments which were meted out with equal and unflinching severity to both sexes alike. The less undesirable punishment was known as pain sec, which Fritz, shortly after my arrival, got for smashing a window pane by accident, and which Harry and Pom-Pom, the incorrigibles, were getting most of the time. This punishment consisted of denying the culprit all nutriment save two stone-hard morsels of dry bread per diem. The culprit's intimate friends, of course, made a point of eating only a portion of their own morsels of soft, heavy, sour bread. We got two a day, each with soup, and presenting the culprit with the rest. The common method of getting pained sick was also a simple one. It was for a man to wave, shout, or make other signs audible or visible to an inhabitant of the women's quarters, and for a girl to be seen at her window by the director at any time during the morning or afternoon promenades of the men. The punishment for sending a letter to a girl might possibly be pain sick, but was more often, I pronounce the word even now with a sinking of the heart, though curiously enough I escaped that for which it stands, cabineau. There were, as already mentioned, a number of cabineaux, sometimes referred to as cachots by persons and linguistic propensities. To repeat myself a little, at least three were situated on the ground floor, and these were used whenever possible in preference to one of the or ones upstairs, for the reason that they were naturally more damp and chill and dark and altogether more dismal and unhealthy. Dampness and cold were considerably increased by the substitution for a floor of two or three planks resting and there in mud. I am now describing what my eyes saw, not what was shown to the inspectors on their rare visits to the director's little shop for making criminals. I know what these occasional visitors beheld, because it, too, I have seen with my own eyes, seen the two balayeurs staggering downstairs with a bed consisting of a high iron frame, a huge mattress of delicious thickness, spotless sheets, warm blankets, and a sort of quilt neatly folded over all. Seen this bed placed by the panting sweepers in the thoroughly cleaned and otherwise immaculate cabineau at the foot of the stairs and opposite the kitchen, the well-scrubbed door being left wide open, I saw this done as I was going to dinner. While the men were upstairs recovering from the soup, the gentlemen inspectors were invited downstairs to look at the specimen of the director's kindness, a kindness which he could not restrain, even in the case of those who were guilty of some terrible wrong. The little Belgian with a broken arm, alias the machine fixer, missed not a word or a gesture of all this, and described the scene to me with an indignation which threatened his sanity. Then, while Le Homme were in the corps for the afternoon, the sweepers were rushed to the enormous room, which they cleaned to beat the band with the fear of hell in them, after which the directeur led his amiable guests leisurely upstairs and showed them the way the men kept their quarters, kept them without dictation on the part of the officials, so fond were they of what was to them one and all more than a delightful temporary residence, was in fact a home. From the enormous room the procession wended a gentle way to the women's quarters, scrubbed and swept in anticipation of their arrival, and so departed, conscious, no doubt, that in the director's France had found a rare specimen of wholehearted and efficient generosity. Upon being sentenced to Cabineau, whether for writing an intercepted letter, fighting, threatening a planton, or committing some minor offence for the nth time, a man took one blanket from his bed, carried it downstairs to the cachot, and disappeared therein for a night, or many days and nights, as the case might be. Before entering, he was thoroughly searched and temporarily deprived of the contents of his pockets, whatever they might include. It was made certain that he had no cigarettes nor tobacco in any other form upon his person, and no matches. The door was locked behind him, and double and triple locked, to judge by the sound, by a planton, usually the black holster, who on such occasions produced a ring of enormous keys, suggestive of a burlesque jailer. Within the stone walls of his dungeon, into which a beam of light, no bigger than a 10-cent piece, and in some cases no light at all, penetrated, the culprit could shout and scream his or her heart out, if he or she liked, without serious annoyance to His Majesty King Satan. I wonder how many times, en route to La Soupe, or the enormous room, or promenade, I have heard the unhealthy, smouldering laughter of girls, or men, entombed within the drooling, greenish walls of La Ferté-Macé. A dozen times, I suppose. I have seen a friend of the entombed stoop adroitly and shove a cigarette or a piece of chocolate under the doors of the girls or the men on the girls, or the girl or man screaming, shouting, and pommeling faintly behind that very door, but you would say by the sound a good part of a mile away. Ah, well, more of this later, when we come to La Femme on their own account. The third method employed to throw fear into the minds of his captives lay, as I have said, in the sight of the captor himself, and this was by far the most efficient method. He loved to suddenly dash upon the girls when they were carrying their slops along the hall and downstairs, as in common with the men, they had to do at least twice every morning and twice every afternoon. The corvée of girls and men were, of course, arranged so as not to coincide, yet somehow or other they managed to coincide on the average about once a week, or if not coincide, at any rate approach coincidence. On such occasions, as often as not under the planton's very stupid nose, a kiss or an embrace would be stolen, provocation of much fierce laughter and some scurrying, or else, while the moneyed captives, including B and Cummings, were waiting... He is Cummings. He just referred to himself in the third person. That's so weird. Were waiting their turn to enter the Bureau DM, Le Gestionnaire, or even were ascending the stairs with a planton behind them en route to Mecca, along the hall would come five or six women staggering and carrying huge pails full to the brim of every one knew what, five or six heads lowered, ill-dressed body tense with effort, free arms rigidly extended from the shoulder downward and outward in a plane at right angles to their difficult progress, and thereby helping to balance the disconcerting load, all embarrassed, some humiliated, others desperately at ease. Along they would come, under the steady, sensual gaze of the men, under a gaze which seemed to eat them alive, and then one of them would laugh with the laughter which is neither pitiful nor terrible but horrible, and bang, would a door fly open, and roar, a well-dressed animal about 5 feet 6 inches in height, with prominent cuffs and a sportive tie, the altogether decently and neatly clothed, thick-billed figure squirming from top to toe with anger, the large head trembling and white face beneath a flourishing mane of coarse, blackish, bristly, perhaps hair, the arm crooked at the elbow and shaking a huge fist of pinkish, well-manicured flesh, and distinct cruel brightish eyes sprouting from their sockets under bushily enormous black eyebrows. The big, weak, coarse mouth extended almost from ear to ear and spouting invective. The soggily, brutal lips clinched upward and backward, showing the huge, horse-like teeth to the froth-shot gums. And I saw once a little girl, 11 years old, scream in terror and drop her pail of slops, spilling most of it on her feet, and seize it in a clutch of frail children's fingers, and stagger, sobbing and shaking, past the fiend, one hand held over the contorted face to shield her from the awful thing of things, to the head of the stairs, where she collapsed and was half carried, half dragged by one of the older ones to the floor below, while another older one picked up her pail and lugged this and her own hurriedly downstairs. And after the last head had disappeared, Monsieur le Directeur continued to rave and shake and tremble for as much as 10 seconds, his shoe-brush mane crinkling with black anger. Then, turning suddenly upon Le Homme, who cowered up against the wall as men cower up against a material thing in the presence of the supernatural, he roared and shook his pinkish fist at us until the gold stud in his immaculate cuff walked out upon the wad of clenching flesh. And you, take care, if I catch you with this woman again, I'll stick you in the cabin for 2 weeks, all of you, all of you. For as much as half a minute, then, turning his round shoulder, big back, suddenly he adjusted his cuffs, muttering prostitutes and whores and dirty filth of women, crammed his big fists into his trousers, pulled in his chin till his fattish jaw rippled along the square jaws, panted, grunted, very completely satisfied, very contented, rather proud of himself, took a strutting stride or two in his expensive shiny boots, and shot all at once through the open door, which he slammed after him. Apropos the particular incident described for purposes of illustration, I wish to state that I believe in miracles, the miracle being that I did not knock the spit-covered mouthful of teeth and jabbering brutish out-thrust jaw, which certainly were not farther than 18 inches from me, through the bull neck bulging in its spotless collar, for there are times when one almost decides not to merely observe, besides which never in my life before had I wanted to kill, to thoroughly extinguish and to entirely murder, perhaps some day, unto God I hope so, amen. Now I will try to give the reader a glimpse of the woman of La Ferté Macé. I might pause there. Now I will try to give the reader a little glimpse of the women of La Ferté Macé, and we'll go into that tomorrow. All right, that's going to do us for tonight. Thank you very much for reading, and I will see you tomorrow.